This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. You may not think of Connecticut as a slave state, but in the mid-1700s, New London County held more slaves than anywhere else in New England. Abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison referred to our state as the Georgia of New England. This fact is one of many that can unsettle our Yankee sensibilities. Connecticut residents, especially the white ones, grew up thinking that we were on the right side of abolition, of the Civil War, and later of the Civil Rights Movement. But the history and the real path for African Americans who live here is much more complicated than just these stories. Today, Where We Live, we're talking about the history of African Americans in Connecticut, from our early days of slave trade to the legacy of racism that remains. Our guests have co-edited a new book that explores this history called African American Connecticut Explored, pulling essays and articles from Connecticut Explored magazine. This story is about more than just a dark history. It's about accomplishments and triumphs. As the editors of this book put it, they want to show the evolution of life for African Americans in the state from a tenuous and dispersed existence to the development of vibrant communities with strong community institutions. I want to welcome in Elizabeth Norman, who's publisher of Connecticut Explored, the magazine of Connecticut history, who serves as one of the co-editors here. Elizabeth, welcome to our show.
Yeah, thank you.
I'd like to welcome in Stacy Close, who's a professor of history at Eastern Connecticut State University. Welcome, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Catherine Harris is here, a lecturer at Central Connecticut State University in New Britain, a place that I have also spent some time teaching. It's very good to see you, Catherine. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting.
And Frank Mitchell is a consultant historian at Amistad Center for Art and Culture. Frank, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, let's just talk about this story that we want to tell, and I'll just go around the table and you can all explain where this comes from. But I'll start with you, Elizabeth Norman. Where does this idea for this book of essays about African-American stories come from?
For speaking personally, I always say it came from a little place of naivete, which is to say that Connecticut Explored had published 23 articles on very, very a wide array of topics on African American history, and I thought, gee, this would make a great book. But what ended up happening is that we didn't really quite have enough material of our own for a book, so we naturally turned to one of our partners in publishing Connecticut Explored, the Amistad Center, as well as the Freedom Trail folks with the state of Connecticut. And that led us to Stacy and Catherine, and we developed this sort of team of people to put together this book, and we added material and here it is.
So we have a team of people here. I mean, how did this book come together? Explain a little bit about this process, Stacy.
Well, for me, it was hearing from Elizabeth, but also knowing Catherine from past talks around Connecticut in the Hartford area, and in large part my own students at Eastern Connecticut State University, who years ago when I first started teaching asked me about the African-American presence here in Connecticut. And so it allowed me the opportunity to do some searching. And that actually aided me in the process of working on the book.
Catherine, how about you? Tell me what brought you into this and why this project is so important to you.
Well, one of the members of the Connecticut Freedom Trail Committee, Mrs. Cora Murray, mentioned the book to me and Mrs. Norman. And I wanted to work with the project because of that connection and also being a historian and specialties with African-American history. I wanted to lend whatever expertise I had on the subject.
Frank, how about you?
Well, the Amistad Center has a really rich collection of objects and artifacts, many of them Connecticut-focused. And so we're always looking for ways to partner with organizations. And Connecticut Explored is one of our best friends and allies in doing this kind of work. So as the project is coming to fruition, it made total sense for us to jump on board and think about how we could share the collection in this publication.
Do you think that this is a story, the story of African Americans in Connecticut, a story that is in some ways misunderstood, Frank? Do you think it's a story that we didn't quite understand well enough as a state?
I think we're at an interesting place. There's been a lot of work done over the past 20 years, and so there are plenty of folks around Connecticut who know aspects of this history because of the Freedom Trail, because of a lot of work that's been done here at CPTV to sort of celebrate the history. And so there are people who actually have done a lot of work and know a good deal about Black Connecticut history, and there are folks who are just beginning to think this through. And so this project comes about at the right time where we could really synthesize some of the early work that's been done and tell a much richer and fuller story than we've been able to 10 years ago.
And Catherine, what is a bit of that story? I alluded to it in the introduction that for many Connecticut residents, we see ourselves as being on one side of history, but as you dig deeper and as we We did some work here around the anniversary of the Civil War recently, and some work that was done at CCSU. You start to find more and more things that run counter to the narrative that you would think about a New England state. So I guess I'm wondering if you can talk about the perceptions of Connecticut residents of the story of African Americans here and the reality that you know well.
It's remarkable that I still run into people who think that the African-American experience began in the early 20th century or late 19th century. They don't have a very complete picture. They also think of Connecticut as being immune from the larger institution of slavery. But as the work points out, neither of those things are true. And trying to place the African-American experience within the context of Connecticut history has been a major goal and also a challenge.
This long history that we're kind of coming to grips with within this book, it's obviously much bigger than even what you could include in here. But I guess I'm wondering if you can just explain, Elizabeth, how you eventually decided that these would be the stories, that this would be the way in which you tell this tale from settlement all the way to the middle part of the 20th century and in a bit beyond.
Well, we knew that we had to take the 23 articles that we had previously published and link them together. They didn't in and of themselves tell the entire story. Again, a little bit of my naivete, I didn't really realize how much, as Frank talked about and Catherine and Stacy both know, how much scholarship has been done, but it's been done at the academic level. So what I saw the purpose of this book is really to bring that scholarship up to what I call the public history audience, the typical kind of reader like myself, any typical reader of Connecticut Explored. To give that full long arc. So that was the structure, to take individual stories that I see as kind of case studies, and they're fascinating stories about individual people or events at a moment in time, but really be able to see how did they relate to the larger picture, both, you know, historically in their time and sort of across the 300 years.
And I think we want to get to some of those personal stories, those individual stories, as we talk about this book here. I guess I'm wondering, Stacy, quickly before we move on, is there one thing that you think that people miss about the history of African Americans in Connecticut? Something that, you know, school students just don't really pick up on until they begin to read a little bit deeper, including some of the work that you're doing here?
Well, what I think what a lot of people will see with this is the ties between what goes on in the South, for example, and what goes on in the North, and how there's this intimate tie in terms of the history of people of African descent in the South with those in Connecticut.
To talk a bit more about that, I mean, let's flesh that out a little bit, because as we look to the South, we think about a very different culture. We think about things that are in many ways foreign to, as I said before, our Yankee sensibilities, our New England identity of who we are. What are some of these ties that we explore here and that are important for people to know about?
Well, one of the things that I discuss is that period after the Civil War. The Civil War, of course, brought in terms of freedom, of physical freedom from slavery, but there were still some shackles certainly to be dealt with. But in that period after the Civil War, there are these ties whereby which African Americans from New England, and particularly from Connecticut, are willing to go into the South to educate their brothers and sisters who are just out of slavery. People like Rebecca Primus, for example, will go into the South, work as educators in helping further that freedom process and trying to acquire greater education. And as the decades move forward, this struggle for education in terms of leadership will eventually bring to the fore Booker T. Washington, who is not only a leader in the South among African Americans, but inside Hartford, there are groups of men who see him as a key leader in their movement for freedom.
We're talking today with Stacy Close and Elizabeth Norman, Frank Mitchell, and Catherine Harris. They're all co-editors of a brand new book just out. And this book contains a number of essays from Connecticut Explored. It's a magazine of Connecticut history. This book is called African American Connecticut Explored, and we're going to be going through it on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day here on Where We Live, talking about some of the stories. It does follow a chronological path, so perhaps we can follow this chronological path throughout the history of African Americans here. And I'll start with you, Catherine Harris. You work extensively on this first part of the book, Settlement to 1789. You've already said, I mean, a lot of people believe that African-American history starts at some point maybe in the 18th, 19th century, but it goes all the way back to the early settlement days. Explain.
The explanation. Well, the presence of persons of African descent is definitely connected to the institution of slavery, but that connection started when the colony was the colony before there was a state of Connecticut, and that presence could be found all over the colony first and then the state. So with regard to how we look at the origins, it's that contradiction between a society dedicated to freedom and at the same time slavery persists. Those individuals of African descent are denied that freedom, but most of the individuals come with that goal of freedom, and African Americans were not excluded from that. So there's going to be this ongoing contradiction and this ongoing struggle for freedom and human dignity that starts the African American experience and continues.
I'm wondering if you can tell one of the stories that I think some of our listeners will be familiar with, the story of Fortune. Who'd like to tell that story?
Well, I know a little bit about Fortune. He was the enslaved person of Dr. Preserve Porter, and unfortunately, his skeletal remains show an enormous amount of abuse and wear and tear on his muscular frame as well as his skeletal frame. Ultimately, Fortune passed away, and the doctor decided to use him for anatomical studies, and his skeleton remained on display at the Mattituck Museum until the latter part of the 20th century. And some scholars decided to, really the community as well, decided to give the person that they call Larry, who was, again, Fortune, a proper burial. But they studied the skeletal remains, and the lessons that they learned really told the true story of slavery. Many people think if slavery existed in Connecticut, it was somewhat benign. Fortune's story tells us a very different story.
And is that one of the reasons that that story resonates so much? Is, again, it runs against the grain, Frank, of what we believe slavery in Connecticut must have been like?
It certainly does that in some ways, though it reinforces some expectations we have. But also in sort of the gift of Fortune, if you will, is the ways in which he allowed the community to come together to become a research unit. He went to Howard University. He went to UMass Amherst, that area, for research and study. He really taught Waterbury and other folks about slavery, but also about sort of reconciliation, about how creativity plays into that. So the poetry, the musical productions, the community meetings and the organizations that came together around learning about the skeleton and then burying this man and giving him the dignity he deserved was really incredible. And it was sort of a great model for everybody in the state for ways to sort of make sense of and celebrate and sort of, I guess, put to rest is the wrong word, but I guess ultimately put to rest these sort of really difficult moments in our history.
What's so interesting, though, about this particular history is it's a person who we don't, frankly, get to know as much about as some of the other stories that are told in this book, people whose accomplishments are well-known, who we have oral or written histories of. But this is a person in death who does so many of the same things. I just think that there's something amazingly powerful about that, that's someone who we don't know very well can bring so many people together.
That's true. At one point, we did go down to see the skeleton while it was at the lab at Howard University, and there were undergrads doing research, and I thought, this is really amazing. It's amazing that this skeleton, 100 years, 200 years after the fact, can have this impact sort of beyond Connecticut and sort of impact these young people's lives and do just what we'd want something awful like this to be able to lead to.
In this early part of the book, this early part of African American history, are there some other stories that are favorites of yours or things that you want to maybe draw attention to, Elizabeth?
I think the story, I love them all, but so you're making me pick. But
pick amongst your children, yeah. I know.
I think one of the interesting stories that historian Peter Hinks provided for us was about Caesar and Lois Peters. And what's interesting about this story is they were enslaved by Reverend Peters. But Reverend Samuel Peters was a loyalist. So during the Revolutionary War era, he actually fled to England and left Caesar and Lois behind. And they just picked up and carried on. They farmed. They were very productive. They had their family. They were productive members of the community. But at some point, Reverend Peters decided he wanted them back, and he tried to he sent slave catchers to try to capture them. And the townspeople rallied around this couple and their family. And it's really a wonderful story about on many different levels, but in this case, particularly how the community rallied around. I would say that might be an exception to the stories of that era. So it's a story I hadn't expected, and I think that's what I like is some of these stories. They don't have the outcome you think you're going to read about. You're surprised.
Who are the black governors?
Oh, the black governors was that was a name for African-American leaders, and many of them were African-born, but by the 19th century, most of them were American-born. The idea of the black governor derives from the late 18th century. The first mention was in New London, and some of the local historians took me to the ancient burial ground and showed me a headstone that said, Floria, wife of Hercules, black governor of the Negroes. And as I investigated this more, and I'm not the first one, Mrs. Billy Anthony and her class and others have written about the topic even long before us. So there was a lot of intrigue about this whole notion of the black governors. But the idea was not that they were actually governors of the state. They did not act in the same capacity as Governor Trumbull or any of the future governors of the state of Connecticut, but they had a leadership role in the black community. And I suggested that that leadership role derived from some of their African political experiences, because many of them were actually born in Africa. In fact, Boston Troutro was born in Africa. He was the black governor in the Norwich area. And the local historians took me to the cemeteries and pointed some of these burials to me. I did not know about them before that, but that is a general explanation. I can talk about some of the things they did. A number of the black governors advocated for independence, for freedom, for emancipation. Some of them fought in the Revolutionary War, and so that was a role that was rather informal. It was not actually stated the black governor does this, but the idea of community, the idea of abolition, the idea of education, employment, and looking out for the welfare of the community, that was the role of the black governor.
And was there any fear of people in these leadership positions having followers, people who listened very closely? I mean, were the black governors people to be feared?
The irony is that the white community seemed to admire them as much as the black community. And as we look at the African-American experience in Connecticut, that's one of those issues that I don't have a firm answer to. In fact, at some of the ceremonies, the people carried rifles and swords, and this is hard to explain in a community where enslaved individuals lived and where there was some apprehension about any African Americans carrying weapons, yet that happened. So they were not feared in the sense that we think of the fear, but there was some appreciation for them and even admiration within some of the white families for them. There was also sarcasm meted out towards the black governors. And one commentator called Samuel Huntington the black Mongol. I think that was her reference to him. But at the same time, the idea and the process continued well into the mid-19th century on the eve of the Civil War. That was the last black governor.
We're talking with the co-editors of a brand new book called African American Connecticut Explored, which takes some essays and articles from Connecticut Explored magazine. We're talking about this history on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We'll be back with more right after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with the co-editors of a brand new book called African American Connecticut Explored. It takes essays and articles from Connecticut Explored magazine. Elizabeth Norman is here from Connecticut Explored. Frank Mitchell is here from the Amistad Center for Art and Culture. Stacy Close from Eastern Connecticut State University. Catherine Harris from Central Connecticut State University. They are all co-editors of this book, and we're going to continue our trek through African American history as told in this book. Fascinating personal stories. I guess I should ask you, Frank, to just spend a little bit of time telling us the story of the Amistad, and maybe the story of the Amistad that we don't know, the one that we didn't see in the movie, the Amistad story that you love to tell people that don't know everything about the history.
Okay, so the Amistad Center is not affiliated with the schooner or the actual incident. So I guess the story I love to tell that's not tied to that is the story of our founding. And we are a collection of art and artifacts compiled by Randolph Lindsay Simpson. He was New Haven-based, really, really committed to the history of Lincoln and Frederick Douglass, and a passionate collector who amassed this really amazing collection that's pretty broad in its disciplines of photography, fine art, books, manuscripts, ephemera. And that came to us a little over 25 years ago, and we're based in the Athenaeum, a partnership there, and we interpret that collection, celebrating the diaspora, history of the diaspora, really, and focusing on education, scholarship, and social experiences.
And I assume that education, that scholarship and social experiences, those are things that you're hoping to get more people involved in, more young people involved in all the time. I assume that there's a lot of interest in this history.
There is. We have a pretty strong relationship with our initial and core audience, always looking for more folks to come visit us. Actually, MLK Day will be the last day of our current exhibition, Emancipation! And we'll be moving our show to places all around the city of Hartford for the next year while our galleries are under construction, along with some parts of the Athenaeum. And we'll return to our space in about a year, and the museum will open a space above us as well. So you'll come back to refreshed and renewed Athenaeum with a lot more gallery space and a new Amistad Center within the Athenaeum as well.
Stacy Close, tell me some of the stories in this volume that you are particularly proud of or close to, some things that you want to point out to our listeners.
One I'll talk real briefly about is the work of Lucy Roberts from New Haven. She was instrumental in helping to build the St. Luke's Episcopal Church. She works as a laundress in 1907, and she is able to save some $5,000 that she uses to help build the St. Luke's Episcopal Church in New Haven. That church, of course, is directly tied to the founding of the St. Monica's Episcopal Church in Hartford. So there, again, are these wonderful ties between different communities in Connecticut that you have. You also have, around 1902, the story of G. Grant Williams, who was a barber and also a seller of literature, including the leading black newspapers of the day, as well as volumes and novels written by blacks. And he sold them from his store in Hartford, in part because he wanted to help to promote the reading of literature, but also because he was a devotee of Booker T. Washington, and he wanted to lift himself up by owning his own business.
You mentioned the church as one of your favorite stories. Talk a bit more about the roles of black churches, of places of worship, and some of these stories in the long history of African Americans in Connecticut.
Well, churches were not only simply places of worship, but they also became meeting houses for major events that happened throughout the years. They also helped to provide the leadership, and they taught leadership skills to people who were often thought of as not being true leaders, but inside their churches and inside their community. A crucial component of the leadership of the African American community has always been the church, and it goes back for hundreds of years, and it's very clear in terms of what happens in Connecticut.
I know that a large part of what you've written about in this book, Catherine, traces some of the history that continues to this day, because we can actually see the Underground Railroad. We can actually go to some of these places. I'm wondering if you can talk to people who don't understand enough about that history and the places that persist, that are actually available to go see, to walk amongst in our state.
Well, one of the stations of the Underground Railroad was Deep River, Connecticut. And there's a story about William Winter, who was an enslaved young man. His actual name was Daniel Fisher. And he traveled via the Underground Railroad through Deep River and up to New Haven. But those are some of the station sites, and they are marked actually on the Connecticut Freedom Trail. Many sites are in Farmington, and they are available for the public to go and visit. There are wonderful educational opportunities, and also they help people to understand that the Underground Railroad was a secretive, clandestine entity. It was not something that was publicized, and so people did participate as conductors and also as travelers at their own risk, the pain of death. And so this was one of the vehicles that many enslaved African Americans used to obtain their freedom, but it was also a vehicle that many white Americans used to indicate their adversity and their anger towards the system of slavery.
That history, it seems, is something that, while publicized to a certain extent within the state, you can find out through historical websites places to go and celebrate that history. But it almost seems as though Connecticut's role could even be bigger and broader. We have so many people who come on our show and talk about trying to celebrate Connecticut history. But this piece of Connecticut history is I think, something that could maybe even be shouted about a little bit more loudly, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree, and I think that's the role of the book. I guess we like to celebrate what I'll call Connecticut exceptionalism as much as anybody, that, you know, we were bigger and better and smarter.
I didn't know that's a thing.
I think it is a thing. But on the flip side, I think the role of history and learning is really to have a grounding and an understanding of how we got to where we are today. To understand sometimes how our fear of change we can see episodes in history where our fear of change left us on the wrong side of an issue that we now know we were on the wrong side of. So I think this is an opportunity to just deepen our understanding of our history, certainly the high points, but certainly some of the low points.
And I think it's getting to some of those low points as well, because many people that we talk to on the show who celebrate history and want to celebrate history, you know, do want to mention those high points, the fact that we were a state full of innovators, but not necessarily mention the fact that the technological or industrial innovations had some dark pieces to them as well. And I feel like that's a difficult conversation, I think, for historians to have, isn't it? Because you want people to embrace the story. You want people to be attracted to it. But sometimes it presents a fairly dark picture.
It does, I guess. But for me, that's where I think these case studies, these individual lives that we learn about in this book, the William Lanson story is really compelling. I guess that's why I like that approach, because this is a real person's life. They had a trajectory. They had successes. They had wins. They had losses. They had tragedies. They had triumphs. And we all have that in our life. So in reading about that, and then particularly being able to place them in a larger context, I just find very enriching, I guess, as an individual.
One of the individual stories that, Frank, I think you write about in this book is the Fisk Jubilee Singers Tour the North. Mm. Tell us the story.
Sure. The Jubilee Singers were children of enslaved blacks who were attending Fisk University, Fisk School at that point, and needed to raise money to keep the school in business in those years after the Civil War. So in 1871, under the tutelage of Ella Shepherd, they go on the road and meet up with some resistance to the kind of music they're singing. And it's sort of a larger tale of the creation of a particular performative idiom in black music and performance styles. So initially the songs and the way that they're singing the songs that their parents and grandparents sang under slavery aren't well received. And they're singing them in a way that sounds like concert art songs, and people don't think that's authentic or real or right. By the time they get to New York, they find some champions, there's a Beecher involved, and before you know it, the tide turns, and they're getting the kind of reviews they want and are beginning to kind of change the way people see black performers. And so they're not, future audiences don't come to the concerts expecting to see them clog dancing or tapping or telling jokes or doing the kind of things that they expect from a certain kind of performance idiom, but happy to see them singing songs in the way that they were. Mm-hmm. And they succeed and they prosper and they take home the gold so that they're able to fund parts of the campus. And they tour the world and they sort of brand the Jubilee Singers as a sort of namesake icon, and future alum are able to kind of go out on the road and bring in more bucks.
Hey, that story that you just told sounds, I think, to me like a microcosm of a lot of the black American artistic experience. It's sort of in a nutshell, this idea of it's not exactly what people want, but then eventually it rises above and there's quite a bit of success there. But this is a microcosm of a lot of other people's stories.
Yeah, it's incredibly condensed, and there are a lot of really important musical performers who have a spin as Jubilee Singers and go off on their own, and they create sort of a performance tradition. So using art songs, but also bringing in sort of concert performers and comedians. Basically, they invent the early vaudeville at some level. But it's all happening on that tour in some ways before anybody really knows or understands what they're giving birth to.
We're sort of jumping around here, but there's a story in here about Marian Anderson's studio.
You know, Marian Anderson was not from Connecticut, but she sought out a kind of a refuge here in the state. And so she and her husband bought property and had a home and her studio here that really could be a place that she could escape to and have refuge. But she very much became part of the community in Danbury as well. She was well known there and performed there. And that is a site that her studio is open to the public through, I think, the Danbury Historical Society. And it's one example of a number of celebrities, we'll call them Paul Robeson and Jackie Robinson, who came to the state and lived here for parts of their lives, not from here, but Connecticut plays a role in their lives.
And maybe in a bit we'll tell the story of Jackie Robinson, but because we're talking about artists, let me skip ahead to a story that's told in here by Melanie McLean, somebody that I know, about her father, Jackie McLean. Who'd like to tell the Jackie McLean story? Because, I was always a huge fan of his, and one of the great failures of my life is, while I got a chance to meet him a number of times in person, I never got to really sit down in front of a microphone with him and have a long-form conversation about a very complicated guy with a very complicated career who helped an enormous number of young people in Hartford and the greater Hartford area learn music but also learn a lot about life. Who'd like to talk about Jackie?
We Melanie McLean, I'll just speak – I don't want to speak for Melanie McLean, of course, but she did write this piece for Connecticut Explored as a very personal memoir. And as we all agree with you, we really wanted to have jazz and music as such an important part of the African-American experience reflected in the book. And Jackie McLean is again, not from Connecticut, but adopted Connecticut. And so we have adopted him and celebrate his great contribution and the development of the program at the University of Hartford and all that he has contributed. So that's recounted very much from her very personal point of view, which is another thing that I really love, because that's a perspective that you don't often get in history. And so that's just celebrated in a short piece here.
We're talking today with Elizabeth Norman from Connecticut Explored magazine, Frank Mitchell, who's here from the Amistad Center for Art and Culture, Stacy Close from Eastern Connecticut State University, Catherine Harris from CCSU, and they're joining us to talk about a brand new book. It's a collection of essays and stories called African American Connecticut Explored. When we come back, we'll hear more stories and talk more about this rich history here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, when an estimated 1.3 million Americans lost their unemployment insurance in late December, all eyes turned toward Congress to see if these benefits would be extended. Well, that debate remains unresolved, leaving those out of work without any form of safety net. On the next Where We Live, we're putting a magnifying glass to some of the key issues surrounding employment and unemployment in Connecticut and America. I hope that you can join us. Tomorrow, you can always join us online at WNPR.org. Today in the program, we are talking about a brand new book. It's African American Connecticut Explored, pulling essays and articles from Connecticut Explored magazine. Some of the co-authors, the co-editors of this volume are with us. Elizabeth Norman from Connecticut Explored magazine, Frank Mitchell from the Amistad Center for Art and Culture, Stacy Close from Eastern Connecticut State University, and Catherine Harris, lecturer at Central Connecticut State University. We're moving all throughout this book that paints a rich history from pre-colonial Connecticut all the way to the middle of the 20th century. And we mentioned Jackie Robinson, Stacy. So let's tell the Jackie Robinson story here. What are his ties to this Connecticut African-American story?
Well, of course, many people know that Jackie Robinson helped to shatter the color line in terms of professional baseball. But he was also a resident of Connecticut for a number of years. And that move from New York to Connecticut came about in part because his wife wanted his family to be in a different place where the children could be raised in a different setting. And so they've wound their way to Stamford, Connecticut, in part because of a story that appeared in a newspaper, but also in part because of help from a local resident by the name of Andrea Simon of the Simon & Schuster fame. And so they found a place to live in a location along what was called Cascade Road, and there they set about raising their family further. But for Jackie Robinson, he had already shattered the color line in baseball, and then he proceeded to become an integral part of the modern civil rights movement. He saw his life as being one of service, not just service in terms of what he had done in baseball, but also what he could give to the modern civil rights movement. When it came to churches being burned in the South, Robinson willingly went into the South, not only to look at the damage, but also to let people know that he was willing to help raise funds to rebuild those churches. And that became part of his mission. And he, like a number of leading black professionals at that time, professional athletes, saw their role as not just to play sports, but also to provide freedom for others who didn't have freedom throughout the country. As a result of that, he also would run headlong into the issue of the Vietnam War. Robinson, of course, was a veteran of the military, and he would have to watch as his son went off to war in Vietnam and as his son would have to battle with the horrible things that come with war, particularly for veterans in terms of the problems that they have. And so for Robinson, it was an issue of battling these crucial issues in civil rights, but also battling with the issue of Vietnam, plus urging baseball to do more than it had done in the past, particularly when it came to black managers. He urged baseball in the 1970s to come to the point where they would allow a black manager to run a team. Now, he himself would never live to see that, but he was at the forefront of pushing baseball to do more than they had done in the past.
I know there's so many stories that we want to get to, and we want to end with one that's in here about Dr. King himself as we speak on this Martin Luther King Day. But I wanted to go back to you, Catherine Harris, because I know that there's one more story that you wanted to tell us before we ran low on time.
Part of the book deals with voting rights, And in this age of the infractions against the Voting Rights Act, I was curious to find out how voting rights were handled by African Americans. I know the black governors had put forth a number of campaigns or petitions for that, but I also found an article in published in 1803 from Wallingford, and it was not signed by an individual, but the gist of it was to ask about two citizens of color, both Democrats, and apparently they were elected to the House, the representatives of the General Assembly. I haven't found much more about it, but it was a curious kind of piece to indicate that even at that early date, there was real interest and real action on voting rights.
Hmm. The story that you have in here at the end of this book, Frank, that I wanted you just to talk about quickly, it's a personal story, and it's about food. There's a little bit of food in this book, and food's very, very important.
Yeah. No, we needed a food story somewhere in the book, we decided, and I am against any kind of boundaries or disciplines, and so I wanted to do something that was autobiographical and also historical that would have food at its core. And it was a great chance to go back to some family stories and family recipes and to try and grow the squash that I believe that my grandmother's grandmother would have made her pies with, and to try and create a pie from that squash that I could actually like or love. I'm still working on the growing the squash. But it was a great chance to pull some things together. And I will plant the seeds again next spring and hope for better squash. And see what happens.
Growing the squash from seed to make the pie. That's the real way to do it.
That's how we roll in New Haven.
That's not going down to Stop and Shop. Mm-mm. And it's a wonderful story at the end of the book. Well, let's end probably where we should on this day celebrating the life and the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. As many of our listeners know, he spent some time in Connecticut. He spent some time doing what a number of other young people, both black and white, did for years and years and years, which was pick tobacco in the farms of the Connecticut River Valley. So tell us about this story.
Dr. King was very much following a trend and a story of African-American youngsters from the period of World War I, from Morehouse College, who had come up to work tobacco after the president of the college, John Hope, had struck a deal for them to come up and work tobacco. So he is part of that generation of Morehouse students who worked tobacco to earn money for their schooling. But for Dr. King, the memory of Connecticut remained in his life because his wife writes about what Connecticut meant to him in her autobiography on his life. And so for him, Connecticut was very important in terms of his college age days, but it was also very important for him during the modern civil rights movement because Connecticut provided not only soldiers from the North who helped in the Southern freedom struggle, but it also provided a resource in terms of funding to keep the movement alive throughout the 1960s. And he built a strong friendship with Hartford pastor Reverend Richard Battles. And the two were often together in Hartford arguing for not just freedom in the South, but also for freedom in the North as well, particularly when it came to poverty and when it came to housing in Connecticut and throughout New England.
It's this idea of poverty in northern states is so very important and still so very intractable. I mean, at the time that you're talking about, the cities of Connecticut were being torn apart and being, you know, ripped apart by highways cutting through communities, people being displaced, black communities being dissolved and in many cases divided then from their white neighbors. And it seems as though I don't know, with all of this history, do you feel like we've come maybe as far as we should here in Connecticut? Do you think that we face these issues of racism and slavery and everything, and maybe the way that we should? I just want to get your take first, Catherine, but we'll go around the table.
I think that the state of Connecticut can face all of these issues. People can do the things that they want when they want to do them, and there's the capacity to do so. I'm not sure that we have faced them to the extent that I'm sure that is needed. And so we have done so much, but there's so much more to do.
the thing that we've heard from many African-American scholars about the history of, say, Connecticut and New England versus the South is it's a story that keeps coming back is whether or not, you know, I want the snake in the grass or the snake that's on the road. The snake on the road is what many African Americans dealt with in the South. You knew where racism was, whereas the racism in the North is often hidden. Do you think we've gotten past some of that history, that idea that we don't consider ourselves racist, but yet there's still this undercurrent of all these things that are still there?
I certainly think people know where the racism is in the North, and that anybody growing up in this area understands what they're up against. The bigger challenge in some ways, really, for me, is the economic challenge, mm-hmm. or the ways in which, and I guess we're beginning to address this a little bit nationally in our political discourse, sort of if you don't have the right economic stake, you know, that is going to carry you through life, and your chances will be incredibly hobbled. And it's certainly true for people of African descent and people of color, and increasingly for others.
Is that what it's really about? I mean, at the end of the day, this struggle in Connecticut that continues, it really ends up being an economic struggle. How much of it still has to do with race, do you think, Stacey?
There are some issues that certainly still have to do with race. And one of the things that Dr. King was doing in the late 60s was urging the nation to address that issue, particularly with his Poor People's Campaign. But he had included in that not just African Americans, but everyone who was poor were part of this struggle, because he could see just what wealth could do on the battlefields of Vietnam in terms of reading the papers, at least. But he could also see when he visited these cities what people were dealing with when they talked with him about what their lives were like. And that Poor People's Campaign, which he never got to see, was still a part of Hartford. It was still a part of New London, where people were marching and willing to go to Washington, D.C. to bring the issue of poverty to the doorsteps of the Johnson administration.
Do you think that he would feel good about the Connecticut cities of today?
Well, he wanted them to be better than they were in the late 60s. And I would think he would want them to be better today.
Hmm. Stacey Close is from Eastern Connecticut State University. He's one of the co-editors that we've had here talking about this brand new book, African American Connecticut Explored. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Frank Mitchell from the Amistad Center for Art and Culture. Thank you so much, sir, for being here.
Thank you.
I want to thank Catherine Harris from Central Connecticut State University in New Britain. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
And thanks to Elizabeth Norman, who's the publisher of Connecticut Explore, the magazine of Connecticut history. The essays and stories that are in this book are from Connecticut Explored. Thank you for bringing this to us, Elizabeth. I truly appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankowski. Thank you so much for joining us.